Government's budget has been met with mixed reviews since it was announced on Tuesday by Alex Allenson. This week, Perspective unpicks some of the thinking behind the budget with help from the Treasury Minister and some of his Tynwald colleagues. Prior to the budget, I spoke to Treasury members Andrew Smith and, first up, seasoned Manx politician Bill Henderson, MLC. There's some very positive things, certainly. I mean, I know you're a left-to-centre politician yourself, and that's evident, certainly, in this budget.
Been a very difficult balancing act this year. We've had many challenges to face, which are still flowing through into this year and possibly into next year as well, with regards to the high cost of living, fuel charges, the war in Ukraine, and even the effects of COVID are still being felt today in many government services, as they are in many countries. Inflation at the minute, although it's flattened a bit for the UK, we're looking at around 4% as we speak. Nonetheless, it's a lot higher than it was, and it's caused immeasurable pressures everywhere, least of which is, of course, staff wage increases and staff and employee expectations and what they should have for wage increases as well. All puts pressure on government and employers as well, increased costs and people's expectations and what government should be providing as a service as well. That's grown, and the pressures on a lot of services have grown exponentially over the last few years as well. So there's pressures from all angles. So really the budget's trying to make the whole thing sustainable, and to try and deliver what we deliver, then yes, the tax rate has had to go up to 22% on the higher rate fill, and it's plain simple fact of balance, trying to balance the books.
And of course, other tax rates have gone up as well. I mean, the corporation tax, those businesses that do pay tax, they're going to be paying, I think, it's 10% goes up to
15%. 15%, yeah. And a lot of that's to do with the OECD Pillar 2 initiative and so on there. But yes, they're going to feel the situation a little as well, albeit from a different angle there, not so much from increased prices and economic pressures, more from international transparency pressures that will be felt from, and as it's a result of more of that than anything else.
As a member of LegCo, your need to regularly assess public opinion is less important than it perhaps was when you were in MHK, but you are a man of the people. So what do you think the public are going to think of this budget?
Well, first, Phil, I'd take you to task absolutely that LegCo don't need to take note of public opinion. I've always done that as a member of Legislative Council, speak to many people, written to, corresponded with, emailed, and I take pride in listening to what people are telling me. So far be it from being ensconced in an office that's disconnected. I'm very much connected with the community. And really, yes, people will undoubtedly be a little disappointed with regards to a tax increase. But when they see what it's funding and the fact that the extra revenue that will bring in for us, hopefully, is ring-fenced for their health service and to continue the provision of the things that our health service provides for us, I think they'll see why it's necessary, and the incredibly expensive, or the, it's incredibly expensive to run a health service, as everyone knows, and with the demand on it and growing demands in areas, as we've seen increasing waiting lists, increasing times in A&E and so on, trying to manage that and bring our health service up to where it needs to be according to the Sir Jonathan Michael review, that's a very expensive thing to do, and that is one of the main reasons for increasing the tax at the minute. It's ring fenced, and as the minister's told us, going forward we'll be looking at ways of working out a health levy payment in the future. The tax strategy should be placed on the Tynwald Register of Business on the same day as the budget for debate in March, as you say, and then there will be a big public debate on that and the various issues and stresses and strains, ideas and so on of how to move forward with our tax regime here in the Isle of Man will be fully discussed.
Andrew Smith is Treasury spokesman on National Insurance. There have been concerns over a couple of budgets now that National Insurance Fund is being drawn down to a greater extent than it's being replenished. How is that going to change as a result of the proposals that are being put to Tynwald?
Well, obviously, National Insurance Fund, we are, due to the reciprocal agreement, obviously we are governed by the UK on the low learning limit especially, and they already announced that they have put a freeze on that at £123 per week, and we'll be following that. Which means that anyone obviously under that still doesn't pay National Insurance. However, in this budget we are increasing the Class 1 thresholds for employees, which will enable them to be better off each year. And similarly, we are increasing what employers pay, so that will make them also better off this year. And we've also increased the upper earnings level, which will take... you know, and ensure people are taken out of the limit where possible. But I think we've got to recognise that the fund has to pay. Obviously, there is a certain contribution which goes towards health, but then the rest is for benefits and pensions. And our island is noted for the way we look after people on benefits, and also we have an ageing demographic, so there's increased pensions. And it's a case of now looking at the projections and forecasts that we do each year to ensure that the income that we raise is enough to pay for the benefits and pensions that we want to commit to. And at the moment, that is the situation. So we're happy that in the last 2 or 3 years, we haven't drawn on the National Insurance Fund for those specific purposes. Yes, we knew during COVID, I think we drew £100 million from that fund, but that was to provide for people that were on the MERS and support the people that were not able to work at the time. However, fortunately, through prudence and good management, that fund has now replenished. But as the Treasury Minister alluded to, as part of his announcement and what we'll be talking in Tynwald further, is that we are looking to review this National Insurance Fund and to see exactly how we need to utilise it into the future. And that's part of the policy of reviewing the fund as a consequence of the GAD report and for future, obviously, funding methods from this fund that has accumulated over the years to now in a region of £1 billion.
And of course, the great thing of having £1 billion to invest is you can make substantial amounts of money on that without even worrying too much about getting contributions in. So it helps that we have that fund. And of course, the UK perhaps, some might even say rather recklessly, they spent their National Insurance Fund, but we didn't. We retained ours, didn't we?
Yeah, well, we did, and I think quite rightly so. And I mean, and I say this, and it's not a glib comment, but as a Yorkshireman, I am very keen on ensuring that we protect anything that we have on deposit. And I've always voted against anything where we're drawing from deposits or we're utilising any interest from the National Insurance Fund in the past. And I would continue to uphold that position personally, because I think that, you know, we've got to be responsible, because it's not just that the today's generation, we've got to show that we're being honourable and responsible for future generations. However, as part of this GAD review we're talking about, it may well be that it is decided that we don't need quite so much in this ring-fenced National Insurance Fund for that purpose, in which case then that can be put to good use on the Isle of Man for the benefit of the people, but not compromising the money that's been accumulated in the National Insurance Fund.
Putting together, though, things like there are increases in contributions for National Insurance, there are freezing in terms of personal rates, in terms of taxation, there are what people like to call stealth taxes, you know, the increases in fees across departments. Probably the people who are going to be most badly affected by this are the people who aren't sufficiently on sufficiently low incomes to get benefits from the government, but are equally not big earners. How do you think they're going to cope over the course of this next 12 months?
Well, again, we're here to try and help and assist these people through this situation. But again, I think we've got to be realistic. Government cannot operate continually subsidising people or institutions or whatever it may be. We've got to come to a situation where we're realistic in whatever we spend, we've got to cover it in some way or other. And as long as the public can see that there is a benefit to them as a consequence of that, be that through the quality of life, be that through education or health or childcare, whatever it may be, if they can actually see tangible benefits, then I can't see a problem in them saying, well, yes, I'm happy to pay a bit towards that. And especially from the income tax we're talking about, which is ring-fenced for health. So I'm quite sure that people say, yes, I'm happy that if the freezing of tax thresholds and the increase of the 2% is to be ring-fenced so that I can get a dentist appointment, I can see a doctor sooner, I can have the other benefits that I believe I should get from a health, from a modern day health service, then I can't see really a problem that they wouldn't be happy to spend that little bit more to ensure. But as long as we can deliver and they see something, as I say, tangible, that they actually do get that extra assistance they're looking for from health.
After the budget, I spoke to Treasury Minister Alex Allanson. Higher tax, higher spend. Is this a socialist budget?
I don't think it's a socialist budget necessarily. I think it's trying to be an honest budget. We've known for decades that we're a low-tax jurisdiction, but with a high welfare spending. And people on the doorstep demand adequate and decent health services, education services, public services. But we've seen the price of that rise incrementally over the last decades, particularly over the last couple of years. So this is trying to bring back a little bit of, I suppose, realism and honesty into how much it costs to run government. But at the same time, underpinning this budget isn't just the headline of a 2% rise in the operative tax. It's also looking at the way we deal with things like benefits to create a fairer society, how we look for a long-term taxation strategy, moving tax away from people onto things like the large corporations that are based here, and looking at widening the income for Treasury, but also looking at how we can instill better value for money and better public services, both in terms of the delivery and the cost.
This is quite a radical budget, isn't it, in that previously Treasury ministers have been very tight, particularly since the £200 million loss in the VAT deal. Treasury ministers have been very tight on public expenditure, trying to pare back rather than substantially increase budgets for departments across government. Is this a kind of an experiment, perhaps, in that it is a departure from where we've been before?
I don't think there's anything experimental about it at all. I mean, what we've had in this Tim world is supplementary votes and individual departments coming forward talking about the increased demands they've had, whether that's more patients needing healthcare, because we have not just a slightly older population, but we can do far more now and the costs of healthcare have gone up. But also the education minister talked about the increased need for children with special educational needs and how that's grown as well. And we're actually seeing more children coming into school who need extra support. So I think it's that reality that the demand has gone up, then we need to meet that demand if we're going to satisfy some of the things in the Ireland Plan, the economic strategy of making this place a really good place to live and work. And I think so what we're doing with the budget is underpinning and investing in some of the key infrastructure. So we're talking about safety, we're talking about crime, we're talking about healthcare, we're talking about education. I think that's all really important. But on top of that, we're looking at revamping the benefit system. We've talked about pensions and splitting from the triple lock there as well for long-term sustainability of the NI fund, but also the tax strategy, looking at how we can grow the amount of tax we take from corporations and therefore lessen the amount of tax we take from individual people, again, to help those working families, as we've tried to do this in this budget in terms of child benefit, but also kicking off the implementation of the childcare strategy with preschool places for 3 to 4 year olds, as well as the established 4 to 5 year olds.
Sam Menzies, the deputy, one of the deputies in Jersey, has described this on social media as a very bold step. This is particularly the increase in headline tax rates, the 20% going up to 22%. It's not generally considered to be a good thing for Treasury ministers to be taking bold steps. Are you concerned, perhaps, that the reputation, you know, in terms of the Isle of Man being a good place to come and do business, could suffer as a result of that headline tax rate?
I'm not. I mean, again, it is a headline. So let's drill underneath the headline. It is 2% increase in the upper rate of tax to 22% from 20%. That's still significantly less than in the UK. But what I also committed to was looking at the thresholds, because one of the big criticisms is about sort of the creep that you increase taxation but you don't increase thresholds. Therefore, more people, because their wages increase, particularly if they're on minimum wage or living wage, end up going into that upper tax band. We need to look at those thresholds. We need to make sure that they're aligned with things like the living wage if we're going to make sure that the people on the Isle of Man who work hard get the benefit of that with money in their pocket. So it is part of that. It's a process. I don't know Sam personally, but I know that in Jersey and in Guernsey they're similarly wrestling with how you provide really good quality public services but keep your taxation rates low. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do on the Isle of Man through the tax strategy is be realistic about it, but work with businesses, work with industry to find a way that we can create the right economic climate, both for the people who live and work here, but also for those big companies who employ a lot of people on this island, particularly some of the also the smaller companies that do as well, and make sure that we've got that right business environment to let them thrive.
If I recall correctly, and you can correct me if you know any better, in Jersey there is already a charge for health and social care. Is this something that the tax strategy addresses and you're hoping to introduce at some point?
Yes, I mean, I think successive administrations have wrestled with the increasing costs of healthcare, which often are higher than normal inflation. And again, that's not just because costs go up. We can do more now with the human body when it goes wrong than ever before. But that all comes at a cost, and that needs to be met. And that's what people, you know, on the street, on the doorstep, have often talked to me about, that they want the Isle of Man to provide one of the best healthcare systems in the world. And if we can't get it right here, then surely we can't get it right anywhere. And that's one of the things that came out of Sir Jonathan Michael's report. I think when you look at funding for healthcare, you need to be realistic. At the moment, it comes out of general taxation, but it's taking up more and more of overall government spending. And so one of the parts of the taxation strategy that we published this Timwald was looking at whether we could compartmentalize that in terms of a healthcare levy. Now, you're right that in Jersey they have a social care levy. This would be a healthcare levy which would allow us to levy that on people who don't normally pay tax on the Isle of Man. Those people, for instance, who live here but have taxable income in other jurisdictions, we could still impose a levy on them because they're using those services. Therefore, I think it's fair that they pay towards it. And that would be a way of ring fencing some of that funding to invest in our healthcare to deliver for the people of the Isle of Man.
Does this budget perhaps indicate that Isle of Man government maybe has recognised that austerity budgets don't work?
I think particularly this administration and some of the things we've been talking about, whether they be climate change, whether they be domestic violence, whether they be the effect of young people in care and people with special educational needs, it shows that actually to have a healthy population, both in terms of their physical health, their mental health, and their economic health, needs investment from government. It doesn't come by accident. You need to create the right environment for that. And I think that's one of the roles of government. That's what underpins a lot of parts of the island plan, which is investing in people, investing in infrastructure, but particularly looking after people when they need help, but allowing them to actually prosper, flourish, develop their skills, develop the opportunities when they're able to. So I think the times of austerity, I'm not decrying them. When we had the VAT bombshell and government suddenly got their income cut quite dramatically, government needed to respond quite dramatically. We're not in that situation now. We do have pressures and challenges, nothing like back then. But we're able, I think, now to look at the use of the reserves, to look at taxation strategies, to develop a plan forward that gives that confidence, stability and sustainability in terms of how we provide services and how we pay for them.
One of the reasonable suggestions that political commentators such as myself would make is that if you want to know what government priorities are, follow the money. And yet, you know, we often hear the Chief Minister and others saying how important it is that the Isle of Man looks good so that when people come, if people are thinking about investing or coming to live and work in the Isle of Man, they have the services and facilities they need. Department of Infrastructure, though, doesn't tend to get much by way of increases in its budget, despite most of what it does being that front of house stuff in terms of things like the roads infrastructure, the airport and so on and so forth. You didn't at the time when you were thinking about extra money for, or substantial extra money for health and education, think that the same needed to apply for infrastructure?
We've announced in this budget quite a significant increase in the amount of money going into maintenance. Again, I think that's been one of the things that's come out of a lot of people's comments, that sometimes things can look a little bit tatty, and all it takes is a brush of paint. All it takes is a bit of tidying up, putting a few bricks back into the right place. And so it's that ongoing maintenance, I think, that's really important, as opposed to getting distracted by a new shiny building or a new shiny thing that you can do. So there is money for that. Also, in terms of the Economic Strategy Fund is there to look at bespoke schemes, whether they be off-road biking trails, whether they be the infrastructure investment scheme, just to try to put that extra effort into creating things and maintaining things that will really benefit both the people of the Isle of Man who live here at the moment, but also people thinking of relocating over, whether that be private individuals that we need because of their skills or be businesses wanting to relocate here as well.
So if I was a relatively prosperous business person with a really good business idea and wanted to relocate to the Isle of Man, what is there in the budget that's going to stand out to me and say, actually, the Isle of Man, above all the other places I could go, is the place for me?
Well, I mean, six people voted against the budget, but we still have remarkable stability in terms of our political system. We don't have a system whereby every election you're not quite sure what the next party is going to be doing. So I think that is a real key aspect of our ability to attract investment here, that stability and that certainty. What this budget does is build on last year's budget, builds on the economic strategy, builds on the island plan to give that stability, to know where we're going as an island and as a government and as an administration, and I hope as a Timbald, because most people have bought into this. So people know that by investing in the Isle of Man, they are investing in the future, both for us here at the moment, but also for their own future and the future of their employees.
But you know as well as I do that in politics you need a few headline grabbers to attract people in to find out a bit more about what you're doing. And the only headline grabber that I can see in relation to the economy at the moment is the 2% increase in higher rate tax.
Well, I can't and I wouldn't tell journalists what the headline should be. And there's this immediacy of media at the moment that everything has to come out straight away. We've had the initial headlines. What I'm hoping over the next weeks, months, is that people will drill down into some of the detail of the budget. There's a huge amount available online. We've got our own web page for it. There's a lot on social media. Just to get underneath some of the headlines, which are fairly short, into some of the depth of this budget, because this is a budget for working families. This is a budget for investment in key public services. And this is also a budget for investment in our economy. And it's not just the budget for one day, which will then be used to wrap up fish and chips. This is a budget for the entire year. And going forward with the tax strategy, the years afterwards.
One of the things certainly that I noticed when I was going through the detail is that this year you're looking to take £98 million from reserves, whereas last year you predicted that you'd be taking something like £78 million from reserves. So that's an extra £20 million in reserves, there's an extra £20 million in terms of the changes in relation to income tax. Reserves, whilst they have remained remarkably stable in terms of the amount that's in there, the percentage as compared with the overall spend, overall government spend has gone down quite significantly over the past decade. How long can we keep dipping into these reserves before they become valueless?
The reserves will never become valueless. Absolutely not. I mean, the biggest part of that is the National Insurance Fund, which is ring-fenced, which is forecast to grow up to £1 billion by 2027-28. You're quite right that in last year's medium-term financial plan, we thought we'd take down £150 million from reserves. In fact, this year we're forecasting that even with some of the overspends and even with some of the increased costs, we'll be drawing down less than that, about £123 million. We've forecast for a slightly higher amount next year to give us that cushion, give us that budget. But I expect that because our assumptions have been really quite prudent, we should be able to draw down less. That's my expectation. At the end of the day, a budget set out in February for the whole rest of the financial year is just an estimate. There are lots of things that can sway you off course, whether that be extra revenue that you get that you weren't expecting or extra costs you get that you weren't anticipating. We've had both this year. What we need to do is get back to a decent balanced budget through the medium-term financial plan, which allows us to actually put money back in reserves, not take interest out of that. And what we'll see, what people will see if they look into some of the finer print of this budget is a commitment to that, but also the fact that that will come into fruition in 25, 26 and 26, 27, that our reserves will actually be growing in total number, although some of the revenue reserves, you're quite right, will be using that to fund some of the improvements in frontline services that we think the public want and demand.
In terms then, a final question really of public spend, what sort of message do you think civil servants, public sector workers will be getting from this budget? Because it would certainly appear to be saying if you need a pay rise, you just lash it in because government seems happy to cover any additional costs that the departments have.
I mean, key to this is recruitment and retention of key staff. But when I've met with teachers, when I've met with nurses, when I've met with doctors, rather than pay, what they're really talking about is working conditions. They want to work in a well-resourced sector. They want to work in schools which have got all the facilities there, which have had a coat of paint on them. They want to work in a hospital whereby they have the right staffing levels. They want to work in a general practice whereby they have the right support staff to help them do their job. What we are doing through this budget is putting that investment into those frontline services, not just for the benefit of the people who work there, but also the benefit of the people that they serve. And I hope over the next year and the subsequent years, we'll see that investment will improve the quality of life for everyone on our island. And if it doesn't, then I'll be back this time next year to explain why.
Jason Moorhouse was one of six MHKs to vote against the budget.
That was a tremendous thing to do because, yeah, when you vote against the budget, you actually vote against the whole government plans for falling 12 months, and it's been something I've been considering for the past 12 months, but just in terms of the tax increase and who that tax increase would impact on, it was just something I couldn't vote for. You know, it was so black and white, and, you know, on this occasion, I vote against it for simple reasons, really.
Because, of course, it's a tax and spend budget, and yet the people least able to afford to pay their taxes are the ones that are going to have to bear the biggest burden.
That's it, and I think that's the bit that really resonates with me, that you actually look at those people working for the minimum wage 40 hours a week, and suddenly £1,300 of their earnings are going to be taxed at this rate. And, you know, for them it accounts for the Monday morning through to the Thursday afternoon, and that's a tremendous input when you're already struggling to pay your basic costs and things like that. So that was really kind of frustrating. It was something that I explained to another member of Tim was asked about, and the minister didn't really make it clear in his explanation at the start. He said, if you work less than 37 hours a week on the minimum wage, you won't be affected, but a lot of people have to work more just to make ends meet.
Former Treasury Minister David Ashford spoke eloquently of his budget concerns. Whilst you didn't vote against the budget, you were pretty critical of a lot of aspects of it.
Yeah, there was several reasons I didn't vote against the budget. The first was that I felt it would be rather churlish this year for me to do so because I laid three challenges down to the Treasury Minister last year, where I made clear if he didn't tackle those three, I'd vote against, and he tackled those three, which was around the funding of education, health, and also in terms of the benefits profit system and some of the work gone on there. But I do have serious concerns, and I've made very clear to the Treasury Minister yesterday in the debate, he's got 12 months to try and sort out this disparity between income tax, which I went into great detail about yesterday, for low and middle income earners compared to what the notional tax rate is for those on higher incomes. If he doesn't come forward with proposals that do that next year, then he can't take my support for granted, and I probably will take the nuclear option and vote against.
Because, of course, the 2% increase in the higher rate of tax is the one that everyone has latched onto. But the other element is the freezing of tax allowances, and that affects people who don't pay the high rate, and basically means that whilst they're probably paying, I don't know what the rate of inflation is, about 8% more, they don't get that uplift in their tax allowance, which means they pay tax on 8% more than they would have done had the tax allowance gone up.
Well, actually, it disproportionately affects those on lower incomes when the allowances are freezed, because those on higher incomes are already over the threshold, so that's already been discounted. So one of the things I laid out yesterday in the debate is, if you actually look at the effective income tax rate, which is basically the physical percentage of your money that goes to the tax man in income tax, basically what has happened over the last sort of decade or so is those on higher incomes have seen their percentage creep up slightly. But because of the freezing of the allowances, the percentage going over in lower incomes has actually gone higher than those actually on higher incomes. So it's increased quicker. And one of the big concerns now is minimum wage. I pointed out yesterday that those on minimum wage, now we don't know where it's going to go in the next couple of months, but if minimum wage goes up by 1.6% this year, and I'll put my bottom dollar to the fact it will go up at least that, then minimum wage people working 37 hours full time will actually suddenly find themselves within the higher rate of income tax bracket. And that'll be the first time since 1988, when differential rates of income tax came in, that you will actually have everyone as higher rate taxpayers.
Ostensibly, the budget feels like it's a, well, at the very least, a left-of-centre budget, high tax, high spend. But the high tax is effectively being borne by the vast majority of taxpayers.
And that's why I don't, for me, it might be something wrapped in a left-of-centre proposal, that the way it's being presented. But I wouldn't say it's left-of-centre, because the people it's actually hammering are the people who are the lowest earners. Those are the people that are actually going to feel the impact the most. And the other thing, which we didn't touch on before when you mentioned all the different things, Phil, is departmental fees and charges. If you go to the Pink Book and you calculate forward, over the next 5 years, departmental fees and charges are expected to raise an extra 15% of income over the next 5 years. So that's all the sort of stealth tax that people always refer to, that you and me all pay. We're all going to get hammered from that as well.
Yes, I noticed that Tim Crookle is getting hammered for the 10p on the increase in school bus fares. It works out at about £39 a year, bearing in mind there's two journeys a day, 5 days a week, 39 school weeks. You compare that with, say, the MUA, where just the profit alone, or the surplus that they expect to make on this coming year, is worth £150 per household. There are lots of these hidden taxes out there, aren't there?
There are, but one thing to say with the MUA is, with their announcement of energy prices coming down, I believe that's worth about £500 a year to households. So it swings and roundabouts a bit with the MUA. I'm not sure that's one of the best examples, not one I would be using. But also, I think one of the other things is, you know, I tried to draw out yesterday just how shocking government is at actually meeting its own targets. So I was being really, really sad, and I've locked myself away and gone back through 40 years worth of budget books back to 1984, when this sort of budget system really started kicking in. And in the 31 budgets since 1992, which is as far back you can go on payroll, because before then they included admin charges and all sorts mixed in, there's only actually four occasions in 31 years since government has actually come in on their payroll target. If that was a private company, you'd be filing for liquidation. You wouldn't be able to survive that, and not by small margins either. In a lot of years, they've been out by about 5, 6%. And that's, you know, tens of millions of pounds in certain years. Now, in the late 90s, early 2000s, that didn't matter so much, because the money was flowing in, the reserves were going up. If the general revenue account didn't balance, you just took some of that surplus and shoved it to cover it. But that's not the case now. Government needs to be able to be coming in on budget, because again, going back to 1984, so 40 years, government has come in on budget in 16 of those years. That's 40%. No other organisation would be able to survive doing that.
You referenced their reserves, and of course, reserves, because of the interest that they make, they have stayed for the last maybe 5-6 years pretty much constant, but there is an impact from taking these huge chunks out of reserves, isn't there?
There most certainly is, and that's always, you know, when we talk about it, just spending the interest, sometimes it's made as if, well, it doesn't matter. But this is going to dip into the capital as well, not by as much as predicted last year. The figures last year were horrendous. So if you look at it long term, it's an improvement, and which was one of the challenges I laid down to the Treasury Minister last year. But in terms of the reserve position, if you actually look at the value of the reserves as a percent of government's budgeted income, which is the best way to look at it, because the reserves are supposed to be a cushion. So if you have a crisis like COVID, cost of living crisis, or the VAT bombshell, if we want to go a bit further back, how much of a cushion do you have? And on the predictions now, the value of those reserves in 2028, which is where the five-year financial plan goes up to, will actually represent only 19.7%. of government's budgeted expenditure. To put that into context, that's the lowest equivalence value since 1989 that the general reserve's been at.
Yes, I seem to remember that at one point it was equivalent to half of government expenditure.
It actually peaked in 2012 at about 72%, so it was actually even higher at one point, but it averaged generally around about 60% for most of the sort of 2010s, if that's the way to refer to that decade. It averaged about 60%, but it is now predicted, like I say, going down to that 19.7. And we say the reserves are there for a rainy day. Well, the storm they can cope with is getting less and less by the year.
Confident that this budget is actually going to maybe surprise us all and result in significant growth in income and budgets, now that all these uplifts have been granted, departments will actually stay within their budgets in the coming year?
Well, obviously, I genuinely hope it does, because that benefits all of us. No one wants a budget that fails. I don't want to be standing up in 12 months' time pointing at the Treasury Minister and saying, I told you so. I would be rather bizarrely quite delighted if the Treasury Minister can stand up in 12 months and go, Mr. Ashford, what were you worrying about? You were talking nonsense 12 months ago. I'd be delighted with that, because it means the budget has worked. But my big concern is that it's not going to necessarily drive things forward. The impact on the lower earners needs to be addressed. And it just, like I say, concerns me. Now, like I say, I didn't vote against the budget, but I believe if you're going to vote against the budget, you've got to have alternative proposals. And the alternative proposal, because they haven't got the health levy ready, and no matter how many of us vote against the budget, it's not going to suddenly produce a health levy. So the alternative to the 2p that Dr. Allenson has done would have been, well, don't give health and education the 59 million. And I came down on balance that I do believe we need the investment in health and education. But it does concern me with health, because we do need to get a rick on health spending. Because I said this when I was minister, I was quite bluntly honest about it, where I actually used the phrase that if you gave the entire government budget to the Department for Health and Social Care, they would probably spend it and then come back asking Treasury if they've got any coins down the back of the couch. What you've got to ensure is that that money has accountability with it, which I also spoke about yesterday, saying, well, actually, what are we getting for that money? What are patients and parents, in the case of education, going to see this time next year, physical, tangible changes that they haven't got at the moment? And that's the question that wasn't answered yesterday, and I'm still waiting for an answer for.
Tim Crookle took the criticism for Comyn's decision to put school bus fares up by 10p.
As with everything else, Phil, you know, things have gone up, whether it be salaries, the cost of the buses, or the cost of running the buses, the fuel and things, but it hasn't been done for 5 years. And as we've just been talking, you know, there was a comment and a criticism made that, you know, they get left for years and then they come back. And all right, it's not big in pennies-wise, it's only 10 pence or 20 pence a day for a return trip, but it's actually 25%, you know, which sounds quite a lot. So we're trying to find ways of sorting that issue out, which we'll talk about later. But it's had to be done. They've not been raised for 5 years.
And in terms of, well, in terms of the people paying, it's effectively £39 a child per year, isn't it? How much does this actually bring in for the department?
It's around £45,000, which in the overall budget isn't an awful lot in the department's budget. But, you know, as I said, you know, everything has gone up recently. So we've had to look at this. We've had to look at everything. And we felt that 10 pence was, you know, a doable figure, if you like.
And then moving on to, well, I suppose the obvious thing that I should ask is, you know, do you understand that this comes on top of a whole raft of other increases that what are described as the hard-working Manx families are facing? You know, everyone is going to pay more tax, almost everyone is going to pay more tax. We'll be paying by way of a range of different fees. And a pound a week doesn't sound much if you say it quickly enough, but for some people that's just the final straw in a whole raft of additional costs that they have to make.
It is. It's something else added on to. And if you've got two or three children, you know, you're up to £60 or £100 already and, you know, over the year. So it does all add up. We absolutely understand that. But as has been said so many times in the last couple of days during Timwood, the debate on the budgets and the overspends and everything else, you know, bills have got to be paid still, and we can't keep dipping into the reserves, although we have done again this year slightly. You know, bills have got to be paid, so costs have got to go up, and it's inevitable. You know, we look at everything. And as we were just talking before, and with the Treasury Minister and that, and we're trying to find a way of doing a total fees, a fee order, which will basically just do all this automatically every year, just put everything up rather than everybody coming back with dozens of fees orders, if you like, over the year, make it easier.
Because there are a very large amount. I know that, having been infrastructure minister myself and having had to stand up in Tynwald to move a range of these orders, and also thinking, and I think I actually said, you know, none of these orders really make sense in terms of the families that are having to pay these things.
Yeah, but it's the time in the administration for officers, you know, and it goes into long, long hours for every department to go through all these. You know, we've got dozens of them in the department down in DOI, whether it's to do with cars or boats or whatever it is. You know, there are dozens of them, and other departments have too, DfE and things like that. So it would make, you know, great sense to be able to do it all in one. But then you'll have the criticism that, you know, it's just been done in one foul swoop and nobody's answerable. But that's not the case. Obviously, we're all answerable at some stage.
In terms then of the department's budget, clearly you're not seen through the rose-tinted spectacles that perhaps the health and education departments are. Do you look and think to yourself occasionally, wouldn't it be nice to be the health minister or the education minister when you see the meagre increases that your department gets?
What, you'd like me to say, oh, to be the health minister or the education minister? I've done one, obviously, years ago. But no, I don't say it like that, because obviously we've got to prioritise, and health and education are the priorities. You know, and we've had a rise, so you know, we're happy with that. Yes, we could always have more. We could spend anything we get given, but you know, and we have to look at how we spend it carefully. But no, health and education are the deserving ones, and then we'll take what we get given. We've put the cases to it, and Treasury have given us what they think is, you know, what we need for the time being and what they can afford to give us.
I did hear a reference to Heritage Rail. I think it was Chris Thomas made a reference to that in the budget. Are you convinced that your budget will be sufficient to pay for the continuation of Heritage Rail in the form that we currently experience it?
Yeah, the amount's come down from a couple of years ago. We're down to about £2.25 million a year, I think, to carry on the refurbishment of the rails and things like that. But yeah, there's still money there to do that and look after them.
And the horse trams, are they ever likely to trot all the way to the sea terminal?
That's the big question, isn't it? It's first and foremost, we need to get Tramway Terrace sorted first and make that safe so we can get in and out of the stables and get the horses in and out running on the half circuit, if you like. And then we'll have to look for the money and put a case back to Tynwald and Treasury for finishing it.
And in terms of infrastructure, the focus appears to be much more on maintenance of the highway rather than the big schemes. Is that something that you think is going to make a big difference now across the island? Are people going to be able to see the significant improvements in the maintenance of their roads particularly?
Hopefully the roads and the footpaths, in that includes the coastal footpaths and those up over the hills and things, you know, the maintenance money, I think, over the last few years has been taken away and used on the bigger schemes and that, and we need to get back to doing the maintenance properly. You know, we'll see how this year goes, but, you know, the island looks tired and at times it's dishevelled in places and there's just dirty signs around. There's this, that, need all sorts of things that need doing. Small jobs that probably cost next to nothing except for the labour time. And I think it would make a huge difference to the island. So we're going to look at doing something along those lines as well this year.
John Wannenberg was another of the budget rebels. You voted against the budget. What were the main reasons you did that?
Well, as I said in the speech, to employ 800 people over the last 7 years on top of the complement of staff that you already have, it is not... I don't think I have the words to actually adequately express how frustrated I can get when I hear figures like that. When you put it in context, that's 1% of the population. Sooner or later, if we continue like that, it's going to be hard to find someone who doesn't work for government on this island.
So that's 800 more public sector workers since when?
800 new jobs in the last 7 years.
So a significant increase. I know were the Treasury Minister here in this interview, he would probably say, yeah, well, some of that is going for things like the health service, where it is absolutely clear that the people in the Isle of Man want a really good health service. Is that not a reasonable thing?
Yeah, it's entirely reasonable if it's true. I don't think it is true. I think it's disingenuous. I think some of those people who are on the front line key services, absolutely. And I think many of them are not.
So how do we turn this round? Because it's not just the Treasury Minister that needs to do this. You know, Tynwald is, well, the House of Keys at least is elected, and the hope, I think, of most of the voters is that you work together as a team to try and solve some of these problems. What are the solutions that you would have liked to see in the budget that weren't there?
Well, for the record, the first thing I said when I rose to speak on the budget was that each of us, MHKs, MLCs, each of us have a responsibility to protect the public purse. So it is not just the Treasury Minister, it's very much all of us. I take that seriously. In fact, when I was campaigning to become an MHK, I pointed this very thing out. So what do? So we want key services, absolutely we want that. But along with that comes a responsibility to make sure that we extract value for money and we control our costs. Now, as I said yesterday, that's the Holy Trinity. And just to do one of those things is to be less than candid. We have to do all three things, and we're not.
In terms then of your role as chair of the MUA, one of the costs that many people are facing around the island, certainly this last year and undoubtedly this coming year, are increased electricity prices. Clearly, the MUA is driven by the cost of purchase of the gas, and that currently is the main fuel that provides our electricity. Can you give us any sort of crumbs of comfort that there may be reductions in energy prices in the near future?
Well, no doubt you did notice we've dropped it from the 1st of April down to 5.1 by 5.1 instead of a rise by 5.7. So that is of comfort to many people. And what I can say as chair of the MUA is that I will ensure that we pay the most affordable price that we can pay. Now, bearing in mind, customers are the reason why we exist. They are the first and foremost thing. But a bankrupt MUA is of no use to anyone.
In terms then, going back to the budget, in terms of the budget, I asked the Treasury Minister, were I an entrepreneur, relatively wealthy, with a good business idea and thinking about coming to the Isle of Man, what would be the headline standout moments from this budget? And it's fair to say the answer that we've heard is obfuscatory. Is there anything in the budget you think that would encourage you as a business person to set up business on the island?
I'm an optimist. There was a wonderful slogan in the 97 Labour election: things can only get better.
Will Alex Allenson's high spending and high tax budget reap economic and service delivery rewards, or is government spending now out of control? Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Go to Myos and Geisha from. Thanks for listening.